Hier ist Radio Tux von der Linux World Conference and Expo aus Köln. Wir haben einen Special Guest heute hier, und zwar John Maddock Hall, der Präsident von Linux International. Und ich werde ihm einige Fragen stellen bezüglich seiner Herkunft und was er tut und was er macht. John, we said we don't want to do much techie talk. Just maybe introduce yourself and tell the people who you are and what you do.
Okay, my name is John Mad Dog Hall. I'm the executive director of Linux International, although I keep telling people that and €350 will get you a cup of coffee in Starbucks almost any place. I've been executive director of Linux International for over 10 years. We started off as being a small association of Linux vendors, very small vendors who were trying to promote Linux and to make it commercial. We started off and just trying to get some visibility for some of these small companies. Some of these companies would go to some place like CBIT, which has 8,000 vendors, and they would be lost. So we would form a little association of them and put them all together in one aisle, and then after a while CBIT realized that there were so many people coming to this one aisle to hear about this software called Linux that they started to take notice of us. They actually allowed us to put on a half-day conference at CBIT to talk about free and open source. Other things that we did as an association was we helped to start the Linux Professional Institute, which does certification of systems administrators. We helped to start the Free Standards Group with the Linux Standard Base Project. We helped to defend the Linux trademark and keep it so that people can call their products Linux if they want to. And we just basically formulated methods and told people about methods of making money or saving money with free software. So that's a little bit about what Linux International is. And as the president of Linux International, I typically go around and talk to people about free and open source software and how to make and save money. I've been doing that for a long time. I've been in the computer industry for 37 years now. And about 25 of those years, I've been using Unix. And then ever since May of 1994, when I first met Linus Torvalds, I've been involved with the Linux operating system. So I've had a great deal of experience both as a vendor of software and as a user of software, both as a programmer, a systems administrator, product manager, marketing manager, a wide variety of jobs inside the computer field. So that's a little bit about me.
So there's something new on the news, like Novell and Microsoft. They did a cooperation just a few weeks ago. What do you think about this cooperation between Microsoft and Novell?
Well, I hope that it all turns out well for both companies. I hope that and for the Linux community. Although I've been in the computer industry for a long time, like I said, I've watched a lot of happenings that Microsoft has gone into deals with various companies. And I liken this a little bit to the praying mantis, where the female of the praying mantis often eats the male, even in the midst of having sex. So I would suggest that Novell simply watch their backside.
That's good advice for the community. I hope all turns out well. You're also teaching, that's what you said, and where exactly are you teaching, and what are you teaching?
Well, I taught computer science full-time for 3.5 years at a small two-year technical college, but that was back in 1977, and back in those days, the first time one of my students would touch a keyboard would be in my class, because very few people, if anybody, had computers in their homes. And even in high school, there were very few computers that people could touch. So basically, as I said, the first time anybody would touch a computer keyboard would be in my class. And we would take students from knowing nothing about computers to having courses in compiler theory and operating systems design and database theory. Not too much in networking, because networking really wasn't prevalent back in those days, and not too much in things like graphics or security, although we did have a little bit in graphics. So it, you know, it was a 2-year course, and we got a lot into those 2 years. And then after I left that, I went to work for Bell Laboratories. That's where I first learned Unix, and I continued to teach at night for another 4 years. But then I started working for Digital Equipment Corporation, traveling around the world talking about digital Unix. And it really wasn't fair to either me or the students that in the midst of a class I'd have to say, well, you know, I have to go off and go someplace far flung in the world and talk to them. And oh, by the way, here's somebody that's a substitute teacher for you. It was bad enough when I was teaching courses like Introduction to Computer Science. I could usually go to Bell Labs or Digital and find somebody to take care of that. But when you're trying to teach a course in compiler theory, it's kind of a rugged course for most people. And to go up to somebody and say, hey, would you like to step in the middle of the course and take this over? They go, ooh, you know, I almost flunked that when I was taking it. I don't want to do that. So I kind of gave that up. But in a way, going around and talking about free software is still educating. And I still have a lot of the same feelings about it. I don't get quite the interaction with the students that I really like. You know, I mean, my favorite way of teaching somebody is to take them out for beer and pizza. But and I really do think that the interaction I had with the students at Hartford State Technical College was one of the best times of my life. So someday I may go back to that. In fact, my retirement project is Mad Dog's Mansion for Math, Music, Microcomputing, and Microbrewing. And I'll have a good time with that.
I bet. So when I look at your website on Wikipedia, there is you can see programmer in brackets. Are you still programming a lot?
I only do the programming that I need to do for my own things, which is still, you know, more than probably the average manager does, because I really believe that a lot of people, when they just look at the graphics on a Linux workstation and they don't get down to the command level and learn some of the commands, they really only see a bare portion of the operating system. I would recommend to anybody that they at least learn a few of the command line commands, you know, for searching, for sorting, for, you know, maneuvering around your directory structure. Even though you can do it graphically, a lot of people find it's faster if they do it on the command line. And it's definitely more powerful. It's just hard for a programmer of any type to be able to anticipate what a user's going to be able to do and write a program that will take care of that. And the command line just gives you so many options. It's like thinking in multiple dimensions at one time instead of only in two dimensions. So, you know, I will. Sometimes I'll be looking to do something, and I'll say, you know, this is silly. You know, I'm doing this by hand. I can just as easily go into command line and do this whole process in a matter of a couple minutes. And so, from that respect, I do some programming.
I mean, I see the problem, but many people starting with Linux and then used to Microsoft, they just know their graphical user interface, and they don't even know what a bash is and what a command line is. And I mean, I understand that. I had the same problems in the beginning. So you have so much experience. You did so many things in your past. Do you have some really interesting funny stories from your students or from your time teaching or from the companies you worked for?
You're laughing because you see a little smile on my face, and yes, I still remember the first time that I was working with some of my students at Hartford State Tech, and I brought a fresh class of students into the computer room, and they sat down to behind each one of the time-sharing terminals we had. And we were working with an operating system called Vistas E, which the main programming language was Basic Plus. So after you logged into the system, you were basically talking directly to the command interpreter of Basic. And so you could type in the word print, space, 5*3, hit the enter key, and it would come back and say 15 right away. And the students, whoa, you know, that was nice. And you say, okay, well, type in print, space, double quote, the, you know, my name, double quote, and hit the return key, and it comes back and it prints out my name. Oh, that's neat. I says, oh, go and play some more. So I was walking behind this one student, and he was typing in, and he said, Prince, space, double quote, the President of the United States, double quote. Kind of like an announcement or something, right? And he hit the carriage return. And it sure enough, it printed out, the President of the United States. And he looked at it for a second, he turned around to me and he said, but it didn't say Jimmy Carter. And that's when I knew we were going to have a long trip in front of us. back in those days, a lot of people thought the computers were going to think for them, right? And so they came to the school because they would see these matchbooks that would say, come and learn computer science, you know, drive a big car, own a big house, you know, meet girls. Or if you were women, it would meet guys, right? You know, and they didn't understand that the computer was not going to think for them, that they actually had to think more than the computer, and they had to tell the computer exactly what to do, that the only thing the computer could do was do what they had told them very fast and many times over and repeatedly without making mistakes. That's what the computer could do. And they just had this very strange feeling of what the computer could do. So that was one funny story. And I think a lot of the other stories I've had have been about things where people would say to me, this is impossible, or this is very hard. And then I would sit down, I would play with the system for a while, and I would come back and I would do it. And come to find out, I could do it in like 10 or 15 minutes. And I would go back to them and I would say, well, look, I did the impossible in only 15 minutes. What if this problem had only been very hard? Could we have done it in 3 minutes? You know? And I think what I found was there were people who looked at a problem a particular way, and they were locked into that method of looking at the problem. And I would come at it with no preconceived notions and turn the problem around. A lot of people call this thinking outside the box. But I would look at the problem and just use, and sometimes what a lot of people consider to be a brute force method of doing it, but it worked. And from the brute force method, we were able to come to do a more refined method of doing it. So, an instance of that was the time that we were going to be taking a version of Berkeley Unix and installing it on a new microcomputer that Digital was coming out with. Now, if people think that Linux is hard to install, they should have seen Berkeley Unix in the old days. Because you first got this tape from Western Electric, and you would put the tape on your VAX computer system, and you would boot it up with just enough information to talk to the center console and maybe one of the disks and the memory of the system, what we call the boot path. And then you'd have to invoke your editor, not Emacs, not VI, ED, a dot editor. That didn't tell you anything until you told it to tell you something. You kept everything in your mind until you said, okay, print this out, and then it would print out exactly what you told it to print out. And so you would then have to type in every single component, every single device. You'd have to type in its address, where it was in memory, its interrupt vector, and what it was. And they always had interesting names like KMC11-B, or you know, DT15-GZ, things like that. And if you got the entire configuration file perfect, then you would write it up, recompile the kernel, put the kernel into place, reboot the system, and install it. And we didn't even talk about graphics, because we had no graphics. All of this was done basically with a hard copy terminal sitting in front of you. And it was very hard. Now, other operating systems like VMS or even operating systems like RISTUS or things like that, you didn't have to do this. It would go out, it would find all the components, it would create the kernel and load. And so I went to the engineers and I said, why can't we do that with Unix? And, oh, can't be done. Can't be done. No. Unix is a completely different operating system. Just can't be done. oh, okay. I kind of went away for a little while. And I says, well, wait a minute. We have these diagnostic programs that go in. They walk the bus. They see what's there. And they output all the names of all the devices. So what I did was I took the diagnostic program, ran it, captured the information into a file, used awk to change it into a configuration file, rebuilt the kernel, and put it back in. All of this, as I said, took me about a quarter of one day. So I went back to the engineer and said, this morning you told me this is impossible, and here, in a quarter of a day, I've got this. And the engineer's eyes kind of opened up. He went back into his cubicle. The next day, as I was walking past, he motions me in. He had incorporated the whole thing into the boot stream of the system, so that no longer did people have to do all this typing and everything. It just made the configuration file and was able to boot the system. So thinking outside the box just a little bit allowed me to give a solution to the customer, which, and that's the most important thing. So you know, I keep running into those things every once in a while, you know, and sometimes it just infuriates me, the words can't be done, you know. I admit there's some things that can't be done. I can't jump to the moon without some type of artificial help, like a rocket ship, right? I can't breathe underwater without some type of artificial help, like an aqualung. But I wish people would think a little bit more before they just say, can't be done.
All right, thank you. There's a big issue on the GPL and the CC licenses. What do you think is the future of these licenses?
I would have been happier if they had first taken GPL 2.6 and cleaned up some of the language in it and brought it up to date so that it was more compatible with modern day things, and then extended GPL to cover some of the issues which are now at the heart of the controversy, to allow people to go in and say, fine, you know, we want to put these extended pieces on. I think the part of the problem is that some people are perfectly happy with the bulk of 2.6 and they don't want to see the things of 3.0 go in. And therefore, as developers, they say, well, we're just not going to incorporate 3.0 into our system. And then there are people who say, well, we feel very strongly about 3.0, and we're not going to do any more work with something that's only covered by 2.6. And for certain projects where there's one person that holds the copyright of everything, like in a lot of the GNU code, that's okay. But in other projects where individual contributors own the copyright and they've just agreed to the license, it's a hard thing, because these programmers have not agreed to subject their code to the extensions of 3. And whoever is in charge of that project would have to, you know, go back and really get the permission of those people to have 3 applied to that, as far as I could see. And, you know, I wish that 2.6 had been cleaned up a little bit before people went on to do the 3.0 license. Or I wish that they called the GPL something else if they wanted to say a 3.0, you know, other than GPL. In a lot of ways, it seems to be strange that all through the time I've been working with the GPL, the easiest way of explaining it to people was a license which gave you the freedom to do all these things. And understanding what the people are trying to do with 3.0, it seems strange to me that this is the first license that says that you cannot do certain things. It's kind of like the US Constitution and gay marriage, right? Where people want to have, for the first time in the US Constitution, something which is against somebody's liberties. And I find that very strange. I've always taken pride in the fact in the Constitution of the United States that we continue to move towards greater liberties and greater freedoms. And the GPL 3.0, at least in some of the instances, seems to be more restrictive than 2.6. So that's my feeling.
Okay. Thank you very much. I'm through with my questions. Is there anything else you would like to say or you would like our listeners to know?
And actually, going back to the GPL 3.0 thing, I do feel very strongly, however, that software patents do need to be erased. I'm not against patents in general, and I think that that's an important thing for the community to understand and say as they go out, that in some cases, patents are useful, particularly where there's a huge investment made that has to be, you know, returned. I think that software patents, on the other hand, are not useful, and they've never really been useful. I think you can take a look at what has happened with the computer science before the time that software patents existed and see the type of innovation and the type of research that was done and how far computer science came forward without software patents. I think particularly now, as we start to move into a new age where the price of computers are dropping phenomenally and people all over the world can contribute their ideas to computer science, that we really need to relook at all of the intellectual property of software and figure out whether we as a world community should grant some type of monopoly to somebody because they came up with a computer science thought, or whether it is better for society as a whole not to do that, not to give that type of protection. There are still protections that can be used by people. There's trade secrets, there's copyright, there's licensing, there's all sorts of things. But I don't think that society should grant the type of heavy-handed protection the software patents give, particularly when there are people who are writing software as a contribution to society. And so even if there was some particular relaxing of the software patent law to say, we will not allow somebody to be sued who writes software that's underneath of the GPL, for instance, I think that might go a long way. I'd like to see software patents eliminated completely. But if somebody is going to have an idea, and if they are going to put it into closed source proprietary code, or if they're going to borrow somebody's idea and put it into closed source proprietary code that they want to make money on, then if that person finds out that they're using their idea, let them sue them. But on the other hand, when somebody takes an idea, either advertently or inadvertently, and puts it into GPL code, they're not going to be making any money off of it, or else everybody can make money off of it. I don't see that that is a place that that society should allow a private monopoly to exist. So I think maybe we need to fine-tune a little bit when we talk about the software patent issues. And maybe we can get a little bit better support from some of our governments if we do that.
Hopefully. John, I thank you very much for being here. It was a really nice interview with you. And I wish you all the best for your future, for the future of Linux and open source software. And I hope you enjoy the rest of the trade fair.
Okay,
so
thank you very much.